Does Monday at the office feel like a storm? Not with Microsoft Copilot. That feeling when Copilot gets everyone up to speed instantly? It's sunny again. When Copilot simplifies complex data so your teams can act, that sun's shining on a beach. And when Copilot uncovers hidden insights, you're on that beach with your people and you find buried treasure. That's Microsoft Copilot. Learn more at Microsoft.com/AI for all.
How do you like the new threads?
Tough! I didn't know you were a Beatle fan, Grandma.
Why? I'm the leader of the pack, baby. Digby.
The Beatles? Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr.
Oh. Real gear, aren't they? They're bottles with Beatle Beetle inside.
What's Beatle Beetle?
The new personality bath. It's a real swinger.
Mild, wild Beatle Beetle with an out-of-this-world fragrance.
I got a split. Here, put a little personality in your bath.
A bath in this mild, wild Beatle Beetle is really out of sight.
Race to your supermarket for the new pink personality bath. Beetle Beetle in the new Paul and Ringo Beetle bottles.
So the opening song you just heard there was apropos of nothing in particular, except perhaps an effort to evoke that excitement felt stateside in early 1964 when the British invasion got kicked off in fine fashion, with the Beatles coming to America, performing the Ed Sullivan Show in February, going on to Carnegie Hall, Washington, D.C., Miami, and that big bang of 60s culture, at least in America, getting kicked off in fine style. If you were there, you never forgot it. For a lot of people, it absolutely influenced their life trajectory, and we'll be discussing that in a future show down the road. But in any event, what really I wanted to speak to was in the Beatle research community, the folks that I personally have come into contact with and become good friends with along the way through intersecting at fests and symposiums and being admirers of their work and reaching out. You know, there's a million ways to connect with people that are really, really serious on a scholarly level about knowledge of the Beatles, acquiring it and disseminating it. And I've met a lot of really good people. I've made a lot of good friends. People, some better known for other things in life that I wouldn't have had any other way of connecting with them, but through being plugged into the Beatle community. So it's just one more aspect of the gift that keeps on giving. But that's a discussion for another day if we really want to go there. In any event, the purpose of this show and my guest today is somebody whose project came about more or less obliquely through these sort of connections that are made in Beatle world. At least that was how he came to my attention and what helped with the end product being the book that was published this year. So to backtrack a bit, my good friend Richard Courtney from Nashville, and I don't want to sound all slobbery when I say my good friend because, you know, it just sounds show busy and that's not what we're here for. Anyway, he is a good friend. And when I visited Nashville a few years back, being the good fellow that he is, he introduced me to a friend of his who happened to have in his house a world-class collection of Beatle materials, of stuff, of product that came out in the 60s tied to the Beatles one way or another. And his name was Todd Jackson. You may recall then, I think it was about 3 years ago, I had him on the show along with Russ Leese on a show that basically gave a little bit of insight into the world of the top of the food chain Beatle collectors, the people with the wherewithal to pursue the truly rare one-of-a-kind items and just amass these great collections that we have been, through various traveling roadshows, been lucky to get access to and check out. I think that my guest's thought had already been in motion when that show came along. But in any event, his name's Terry Crane. He reached out to me. He was working on a very serious study of the Beatle merchandising, specifically the U.S. merchandising, because he's an American and because, I guess, research-wise, it's easier to track down that stuff in the country you live in. And this wasn't a price guide. This wasn't just a catalog of what was made and exists out there. This was a serious investigation of the background of how this stuff came into being, who made it, what deals were made. And really, it all tells a story. It tells another story of the Beatles' arc of success and fame. If you trace the lineage of the big explosion in early 64 of merchandise that came out in the States to exploit what could have been a flash in the pan phenomenon and cash in while the iron was hot, as it were, and how it sort of waxed and waned over the course of their career. By 66, it was kind of on a downward arc. Then the psychedelia came in, and then it got a big boom when Yellow Submarine came out. And that was a dream situation with that sort of crossover appeal to young age groups as well as teens. And on it went through the course of the Beatles' career. So Terry very meticulously researched this for the stories that these items told, what was produced. It's not a price guide, it's not a rareness guide or anything like that, but it's really sort of the backstory that you wouldn't ordinarily get about this stuff. And as you will hear in the conversation, there's always more to be learned, and future editions of the book will be revised accordingly. As far as doing one of outside the U.S. market, that may happen yet. That's up to Terry and the support for this book. We'll see. It is available in a beautiful hardcover coffee table version as well as an ebook. I think there may be a softbound coming. I can't swear to that. You can talk to Terry yourself about that, who has a social media presence. It's a great book. And to circle back to my original point about networking and friendships, it was Richard introducing me to Todd Jackson that caught the attention of Terry. I, in turn, introduced Terry to Todd. And a big part of what is in this book came from Todd's collection. So if you remember that show with Todd and Russ a few years back, now if you get Terry's book, you get to see some of the stuff in Todd's collection. So without any further babbling, I bring you Terry Crane. So the book is NEMS and the Business of Selling Beatles Merchandise in the U.S., 1964-1966. And my guest today is the author, researcher, Terry Crane, Welcome to Sappy, Terry.
Thanks, Robert. Thank you.
It's such a beautiful, well-produced, well-laid-out book with so much eye-popping stuff, eye candy, basically Beatles stuff. What was it that got you on the path to putting this together, doing the research on this? Did you come from a background of being a collector yourself?
Well, I've always had an eye for this. I've always liked this certain genre and all that, all the Beatles stuff when I was young and all. My sister, back in the mid-60s, my sister had some stuff in her room that my older sister and I would always walk by and stare at it in there. And I was always drawn to that kind of stuff. And as it went on and on, this type of items that they had back then just seemed to draw an interest of me that I always liked looking at the coolest stuff in the universe, which was the early Beatles stuff right after they hit Ed Sullivan.
Mm-hmm. So what was the earliest stuff that was in your environment of Beatle artifacts?
I remember walking down our hall at my house and looking in my sister's room, and her Remco George Harrison doll kept staring back at me all the time. And for some reason, you know, that's almost 55 years ago or something, but I can remember that to this day. So I think that must have got stuck on my brain somewhere that made me want to go further with this research about that.
Sure. That was the gateway.
Yes.
So did you, once you sort of came of age and being a Beatle fan, start seeking out the stuff yourself?
Well, little by little. I'm not a huge collector by any means. I just like to get maybe a few items and all that. But it's just the actual items themselves I kept being drawn to. And it wasn't because they were cheap or expensive or how much they cost or anything like that. But just the idea that somebody made that item around that time, around the Beatles era right in there, was an interest to me, you know, not only the item itself, but the history behind that item, what got them to that point to manufacture that item and all. For some reason, that has just been an interest of mine. And I think that what led me to do a book like this, the history behind all the items and everything.
Well, that's very interesting because in my experience being in Beatle world, I find that if there are people out there to collect Beatle stuff, a couple things. First of all, once you get typed as a Beatle person, stuff will come your way, whether you ask for it or not. People will have you in mind if they stumble across something like, hey, you know, I saw this had Beatles on it, you might be interested in it. So, you know, I've gotten things through the years that I didn't necessarily have an interest in collecting, but you're not going to say no to something that comes your way. And then the other thing I noticed is that there are people that are Beatle collectors that I haven't known anybody really well that collects absolutely everything. Because first of all, you know, you need the wherewithal to be able to buy everything plus a place to put it. But most people I knew broke down some sort of niche of what they collected. With me, I was never into the toys or artifacts per se, although if somebody gave me something, that's fine. Mostly what I sought out was paper. Whether it was magazines or books, anything in print on the Beatles tended to be the stuff of interest to me. Stuff like Establishment Mainstream Press, if they were on the cover, the teen magazines at the time, anything out of England was great. Just anything like that where there was a chance of getting an interview or seeing some pictures or just learning something in real time from when the Beatles were an active band. So that's what I've been finding out about people that do collect stuff, is that usually there's some particular angle they've got. And that was never mine, but like you, I was always interested in it, and even more so when you find out there's backstories to the stuff. So at what point did you decide you're going to try to research this stuff out and turn it into a book?
Well, with an interest like this, I would start collecting the price guides. And there are wonderful price guides out there. Perry Cox and Jeff Augsburger and all these guys, they're gods in the memorabilia business. And I'm happy now to be able to say that some of those people are my friends and I talk to them a lot. Mm-hmm. When I went out to look at these price guides, and I'll use the Remco doll as an example, there might be a little piece on there. It says the Remco doll is 5 inches tall. It's got black hair. He holds a guitar. And then the entire rest of the text about that item is about the worth of it. You know, if it's worth this much money, if the guitar is missing, it's worth this much. If there's an arm missing, it's worth this much and all that.
Right.
So I always found that, well, I wanted to know a bit more about the item. I really didn't care. that might sound odd, but I really didn't care what it was worth. I was just interested in the item. So the more I kept looking around at different things like that, I found that was probably the norm, that the actual item and the history was a minor thing that they talked about, and most people talked about the worth. So I started looking into doing some internet searches and talking to some people about, well, tell me more about this item. And I kept realizing that the stories behind the items to me was just as cool as anything that I had been researching. And one of the things that you talked about on collectors that I realized when I have gone to collectors' houses and shot photographs for the books and all that stuff, I'll give you what I think is maybe a perfect example. I was at one collector's house and I was looking at the old Beatles headphones, costs, the headphones that were out there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They're a nice item. The color is great. It's technology. Everything is pretty cool. And he's going, this is a great item right here. Well, out of the corner of my eye, I see the Beatles handkerchief sitting on the back of a couch. Well, the Beatles handkerchief is just a piece of fabric. It's got Beatle in the corners and all that. And I looked at it. I said, oh my gosh, there's another NIMS item right there. It's a Beatles handkerchief. And he said, well, yeah, it's not as cool as the headphones. And I said, well, that's right. But to me, it's another item. It's another of the 150 items that came out around then. So what might sound odd, it was just as important to me as the headphones were. But in the collecting world, you are right. There's people that have their niches. There's people that go for the big ticket items or the small ticket items. And trying to find all 150 or right around that is quite a daunting task for a lot of people. So I think that was one of the things I wanted to do here is I could never find a list. I could never find the list of all 150 items. I had one book might talk about this and one might talk about this and one might. So I just started listing it all and I finally came up with what I thought was a pretty good idea of what all came out back then. And as you know, and as other people know, the record collecting, I mean, the data collecting back then wasn't the best. You know, if you were done with a Beatles item and you were a business, well, you decided, well, we're not going to do any more Beatles stuff, you might throw all the information in the trash can. I mean, there's no
right.
There's no Excel spreadsheets. There was no anything like that. You had a black file cabinet with a black trash can next to you, and that might be where some of these things went to. So the idea of digging some of this stuff out just became more and more of an obsession with me,
mm-hmm.
knowing that that kind of information was out there.
Yeah, it had to have been, on the one hand, very frustrating as a researcher to recognize that at one time records of this stuff existed, but because it was not valued past a certain date, then it was disposed of to be lost forever. It wasn't like there was any kind of digital backup of any of this stuff. So then you have to try to piece things together. And I have found as a researcher that, you know, some of the best stuff you could find is the paper items of the day, where in this case, you get either catalogs or teenage fan magazines where they've got the advertising pages where you send in, you know, you clip out the little address thing and however much money they're asking for to send away for stuff. And it's a great way of getting yourself aware of some of the stuff that existed out there that might be very scarce to come across now. But back in the day, here it was advertised in the literature that would be read by the Beatles audience.
Exactly. And the ads were a big help. There's always somebody, it seems like, that had some ad from 64 or 65 that they've put out on the internet or whatever. Now, it might take a while to run across it. And I'll be the first to admit some of the stuff I accidentally stumbled across. I might be looking for one thing and found something else.
Mm-hmm.
But you look at the ads like that and you are right. They may lead you somewhere else. And I'll use an example of the official Beatles coloring book. Well, you could buy the coloring book back then. It's got about 100 pages in it. And at the back of the coloring book, there's an ad for what they called the Beatle loot tray, which is what you put your glasses full of tab on and walked into the living room. So, and I'm thinking, well, look at that. There's kind of a cross-reference right there.
Yeah.
And it's things like that that helped me solidify what was legit and not legit and what should maybe go on the list of the items. So yes, there was a lot of that cross stuff like that.
So what was that made you center in on the NEM stuff as opposed to other Beatle stuff that was out there? Was it just because it was easier to track, in a sense?
Well, I don't know if it was easier to track because, you know, I had always heard these rumors that there were 150 items that came out right after they played the Ed Sullivan Show.
All of us on the show want to express our deep appreciation to the New York Police Department for its superb handling of thousands of youngsters who flooded Broadway at 53rd Street, ready to greet the Beatles under the command of Deputy Chief Sanford Yarrow. And our deep appreciation to the newspapermen, magazine writers, and photographers who've been so darn kind to the Beatles and to us.
So I could find some of these items, and I was drawn to that. That was right around when I was 8 or 9 years old, and that was the cool stuff that I remember from childhood. And I was drawn just to the coolness factor that those items were out there. Well, then when I started researching and couldn't find the list and started running across items that maybe the general mainstream might not even knew that were out there, It just started growing more and more inside of me that I was like, this is so cool. Now, I will say, for me, there's a natural break in the book. Now, about 1967, all the Yellow Submarine items started coming out, which is another wave of the Beatles toys and memorabilia and all that. Well, I draw the line right before that because that's a whole nother genre that comes out and a whole nother book for somebody else to talk about the Yellow Submarine stuff. So that initial stuff from 64 to 66 that started popping on the shelves of Woolworths and all that kind of stuff, that's the stuff that I just think is so cool. Some of it's great, some of it's pretty cheesy, but who cares? It's all in the master list of the Beatles hitting the U.S.
Well, that's the thing. I wouldn't necessarily collect the stuff myself, but my interest lies, like yours, I think, in what it stands for as an ephemeral item, as something that was manufactured to capitalize on the wave of popularity of something that, for what anybody knew, could go away tomorrow. And so you wanted to cash in quickly. And so it was something that was sort of a token of the esteem that the audience had for the Beatles, you know, what it was they wanted to own to be able to celebrate and immerse themselves in Beatledom at that moment. And you age out of it, or the thing breaks, or you lose it, or, you know, wears out, whatever happens with it, and it's gone because people moved on to other interests. And while the Beatles are still having a career, I'm not sure how much merch was being produced. It was not Yellow Submarine in 68, 69. So they don't have that same preteen appeal that they once did. You could stick their image on anything, from hairbrushes to plastic guitars to talcum powder or whatnot. So it definitely is this token of the time, something that was there today and gone tomorrow. And to me, that's the real fascinating aspect of it, is what kind of stuff were people putting out to appeal to that audience back at that time?
Right. I think one of the things that has been very, I guess, satisfying is the word. It's an interesting thing that I really, as I was starting the book and doing the book and doing this, I really didn't think of this. But what has happened with the book is it has become a great, what I call, memory trigger for people. People will come up and go, you know, hey, I remember this. I got it blank. Or I remember this. Or my sister had this. Or, oh my gosh, I saw these at Ben Franklin or Woolworths or something like that. Brings back the memories of the stuff that you had when you were a kid. And that's exactly what this, I'm finding, is what this has happened. And that's why within the book, I put these quotes from people in there. And once that started, once people start sending me things as I was working on the book that, you know, I remember this wallet or this piece of jewelry I remember because, and once they start sending me things like that, I'm going, well, I'll include those in the book because that kind of stuff is as important as the item itself. It's what memory trigger this item brings to you. And you realize that maybe the Beatles stuff weren't your memory trigger, but everybody's got the memory trigger. Everybody's got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle or the Power Rangers or the Hopalong Cassidy or the Mickey Mouse or something from their youth that is a great memory trigger. And I think that this book, I'm finding, is hitting some people right there in that memories of what they knew about that is really hitting them hard with this. So I think I really like that is taken on this kind of edit or what it is.
That is a really great aspect of the book that you put in there, is actually bringing in these living witnesses to the history of those particular items. Because most people who read the book won't be first-generation fans who experienced it in real time. They're going to be people who have an interest in the Beatles, and to whatever degree they've got an interest in history, history of the 60s, history of pop culture, history of the British invasion or whatever, to really bring home the experience of being a fan, being, you know, what the lives of those people you see in the old black and white films screaming in the stadiums at the Beatles, what their lives were like, what they went home to, what was part of their world. And so you're bringing an invaluable aspect. And it's great that you're able to get these memories triggered by these items documented from people that were there at the time and what this stuff meant to them. So that's a really, to me, it's one of the more fascinating aspects of the book.
One of probably my best story. I was working on the book and I had a lady send me a little story, and she sent me a photo of her standing in front of what was the Beatles poster. And this poster was the one that you could, this thing was almost like 4 foot tall, and it had all the folds in it because it came in the 16 magazine or whatever it was. Mm-hmm. Well, they had a picture. She was standing in front of this poster, and this poster was taped up on their refrigerator. And it was an old grainy photo that I had. And I said, well, this is pretty cool. Well, then I read her story. Her story was that in the mid 60s or whatever, her father was in Vietnam. So they would tape the poster up to the refrigerator. When her mother and her would write her father letters, they would include pictures of the young girl in front of the poster, so he had some kind of idea how much she was growing. Mm. You know, he could take the where she was last time versus this time and all that. So he's opening these letters in the jungles or foxholes in Vietnam, and there's a Beatles twist to this whole story and all that. And I just think something like that is cool. I put a picture of the poster out there in the book, which is great, but to add a story about how that poster was the memory triggers, if I can say it again, for this family and all, was just pretty cool. So the more of those things that came out, the more it just added a neat little touch to the book.
I love stuff like that. And because that storytelling aspect of it, of what this visual triggers, is so compelling, a book like this can exist beyond its life as a book. You can turn this into something like a documentary or a podcast or something where you collect these stories and you have this sort of presentation to them, because this is something that's, it's a much deeper, richer history that resonates with people when they're able to project this emotional connection to these things. So that's a really cool feature of this thing.
Exactly. Thank you.
So when you started doing the research on this, and you've already spoken to the fact that, you know, corporate records of the stuff were pretty non-existent, was there, beyond going to the collectors, was there any clear path, or was it just sort of you chase one rabbit hole down one hole and, you know, you suddenly directed on this path that you didn't really anticipate? Was that kind of how the research proceeded on this?
That's exactly how it went. So I kept trying to put together the list and then maybe start on some information about each item like that. And I would find that I would be looking for one item, trying to do some research and looking very carefully. And I would end up 3 hours later realizing I didn't even go down that way. I went down some other item because of the way the domino effect that all these things attach to each other. And I would talk to collectors. And I got to the point where I did something that really helped me. One of the things I wanted to do in the book, and it's at the end of the book, it's in the appendix or whatever, where most people just kind of flip through and go, oh, the book's done, and they move on. Well, one of the coolest things that I think I did at the end, where it's in the appendix, is it's got all of the U.S. addresses from 64 to 66 of all of these items. And I tried very hard to find where they made the Remco doll, where they made the lunchbox and all that kind of stuff. Well, what I started doing, and that was a whole thing in itself, trying to figure out all that stuff. But what I started doing with that is I would find, maybe if an item said, well, it was made in a certain town in New Jersey, all right, well, I could find no record of it. I couldn't find anything. I'm looking at copyright stuff and all this stuff. Well, I started just writing and emailing like the historical societies and the different societies around that town, the Chamber of Commerce. And I would go, hey, I'm doing some research and I've heard that this item was made in your town back in 1964, 65. Anybody have any recollections? I would write the local libraries and all that. And 9 out of 10 times I wouldn't get anything back. But every now and then, I'd get something back that would just change my day. You know, I've got 2 or 3 emails that said, oh, I'm the curator at the local library. I saw your email and it sparked an interest because I used to have some of these items. So I went looking in the local blank and I found blank for you. And it was like, well, my gosh, there it is. Well, so I started accidentally getting all these volunteer researchers helping me out because when you would tell them that this wig was made in your town at this time, and here's the address of it. Is there anybody that remembers that? When you give them that much detail, it usually sparks an interest on the other end of the conversation that somebody's going to go, well, let's look around this. I've never heard about this, or my mom used to tell me about this. So I would start getting information back like that, and those kind of stories and that kind of information help supplement all the other stuff I was working on. So that was a cool aspect of what came out with some of the items.
Wow. It's like it takes on a life of its own past a certain point.
You just
throw the breadcrumbs onto the water and see what happens.
Yes, exactly.
That's awesome. So what kind of research did you do as far as the actual business aspects and Brian Epstein's role in licensing this stuff and how he got beat up in terms of the deal that he made initially with the people that wanted to license the Beatles image for stuff that he had to then go to court to redress because it was such a terribly unfair deal to the Beatles at that time. Did you look into that background much?
I looked into that. There's a chapter on that at the beginning of the book to kind of give an overview. There's a lot of information out there, but it's just piecing it together of what we think is the correct versions or the incorrect versions. There's a lot of quotes out there that I've got books and all that I go through to try to put something together. And I thought the easiest way for me to do it is to basically look at it as a timeline. You know, here's what happened at this time. And when I did that and started putting the pieces together that way, it all started making more sense. I did email some people and contact some people over in the Liverpool and the Great Britain area to try to help me solidify some of these ideas that I had and all that. That was an interesting aspect to it also, to try to really get it solidified down to a science. I was one day searching one of the New York newspapers in December of 64 when some of the Beatles management people were in court that day suing each other over this stuff. And it's when you start going down avenues like that, that helps you solidify your timelines and all that. But yes, I did a little part of that in the book. I also did one of the other things right at the beginning of the book that I did. I did a little piece on mass merchandising in the U.S. because whether people will agree with me or not, one of the things that I think is, you know, of course, on February 9th of 64, when the Beatles hit Ed Sullivan, 7 o'clock Central Time, that was a big night, changed music and all that kind of stuff. Well, I'll contend that the next morning, probably about 8 or 9 in the morning, there was another bombshell that went off in the U.S. because before that date, mass merchandising in the United States was, there really wasn't that much of it. You know, there was some of the Mickey Mouse stuff. There was some of the Superman stuff and the Davy Crockett stuff. And Disney got involved in some of the stuff in the 40s and the 50s and all that kind of stuff. But mass merchandising itself tied to a item or a project or an entity really didn't exist that much. But I contend that on that morning afterwards, what happened was you had all these U.S. business people, the light bulb went off, and they flew in from Los Angeles. They drove in from New York. They got on a train in the Midwest and ended up in New York, and they were beating on the hotel room doors of the Beatles management company, not of the Beatles themselves, but their management company, beating on the doors going, hey, we think this is a hot item. We want to make some wigs.
We're gonna dance till the sun comes up at the Beatle Wig Party.
And then the next guy would come beat on the door. We want to make some record players. We want to make some models. We want to make some games. We want to make some jewelry. And over the next few weeks and months, mass merchandising, as probably we know it now, I think, was born on that morning, because they all came, they wanted that tie-in with the Beatles entity, and everything they could touch, they wanted to market it like that. So now, when you go to the Avengers Endgame movie, and you go to Walmart and find all the stuff on the shelves, and McDonald's has the tie-in, and everybody's got the tie-in, you could probably trace that back to that Monday morning beating on hotel rooms was the cause of all that kind of stuff.
That's a pretty major point, because I think for most people, you kind of live with this assumption that that had been around always, but it's not true. That really is yet one more thing that was generated by the success of the Beatles. There's so many things you can point to, but that's just one more. That merchandise as tied to an act of the day is something that really it wasn't really in existence, as you described, apart from, you know, something like a Mickey Mouse Club or something like that, or Howdy Doody, whatever it might be, until the Beatles came along and everybody seized that opportunity, because it was just such a seismic shift into culture, that big bang that happened the night that they played the Sullivan Show.
Right. People will say, and they're correct, Brian didn't get a very good deal on the merchandising. They got 10% and all this stuff. Well, there was no blueprint.
Right.
There was no one that really did that before. No one had an idea how this was going to work out. They could have got 10% of nothing.
Right.
As it might have ended up in a week that everybody moved on and nobody cared. So hindsight makes us all brilliant. So when people always talk about the bad deal and all that, well, yes, it was, but that's the best you could get at that moment, because there's no handbook to go by and say, what are we supposed to do in this situation? So they were writing the handbook as they went along.
Exactly. And like with so many other things, the Beatles were the ones that kicked the door open, that everybody profited from their example and figured out how to do things better once the Beatles had made that dent, that breaking through the existing world at that time. So correct. I can't fault Brian for that. There was no precedent.
Correct. Exactly.
So as you were accumulating this stuff, and you have this arc of 64, where it really begins, the day after the Sullivan Show, running through 66 or so, did you notice any particular arc to what kind of stuff was being produced? I would imagine early on, these guys were just shotgunning it and putting the Beatles on absolutely everything, and maybe the formula would have gotten fine-tuned over time. I don't know that to be true, but you could probably fill me in on that.
I think at the beginning, even though they said that, well, we're going to have some industry standards on how we're going to do this, well, probably at the beginning they thought that, but that probably kind of waned a little bit as the more people were beating on the hotel room doors. You get some odd items, yes. I think probably as it went along, the more what I would call probably the odd items probably disappeared, and you get more of the, I'll say, higher quality items, I guess you might say. But overall, that might have been the only arc that I've noticed is some of the interesting stuff. Probably when they had the pieces of cardboard that you could buy that was called Grow Hair on the Beatles, and you ordered the pieces of cardboard, and when you opened it up, there was four pieces of cardboard, and each had a picture of one of the Beatles on it, and their hair was actually this chia seeds that was glued onto this, and you could put John in a glass of water, and in a few days he would grow hair, and it was advertised to you that how you would be the envy of all your friends when they could come over and watch you give John a haircut with your own official grow hair on the Beatles items. Well, probably they got away with more of that kind of stuff early on than they did later. But that just adds to it. I mean, that's, even though it's one of the goofiest things you'll find, that's one of the coolest things that you'll find out there.
That's amazing. It's like the proto-chia pet. I had
that's
no idea.
Exactly right.
Wow. So what are some of the more unusual things that you did find in your research that maybe didn't get the traction of other things and probably are more highly collectible now because nobody knew what to do with them back then?
Well, of course, everybody, they say the Holy Grail is the record player. Everybody wants the record player. And back then, the record player sold for a whopping $29 on the shelf at Woolworths. Well, back then, that was an expensive item for a teenager or whatever to go down the shelf to find that. And there were only 5,000 of those made.
Wow.
So that has become, if you talk to collectors now and everything, that becomes the holy grail. Everybody wants the record player. One of the 150 items I got in the book, there's a skateboard. Well, I don't even know to this day if there was ever really one made and put on a shelf, but they did make it. They had a prototype. They took out ads in all these trade magazines this company did for the Beatles skateboard. I found the ads in the old 1964 magazines where there was the release of the skateboard and all that, and something happened that no one I have talked to has ever been able to find it or has it anymore. So it might have got so far in production and they may have made a few and tried them out in the street outside or whatever, but I don't think that one has ever made actually a shelf. So that's one that people are looking for. And one of the things along that line that I kind of think is interesting about the book, and again, this came afterwards, is there's 150 items out there. Well, I'll give presentations about these items and start talking about all that. Well, I will have people stop me after the presentation. And they'll go, you know what? We were there in 64 and 65 and 66. That was prime time for us. We were teenagers and all that. And they'll go, we collected everything we could find. And then they would pause and they would look at me and they go, and you know what? We didn't even know half this stuff even existed of your list here. And so I thought that was interesting. And I had a couple of people who told me that. So I did some more research on that. And I found out that there were actually really two answers to that. One of them is, yes, the Beatles merchandise, like a lot of stuff back then, was directional. You had the West Coast and the East Coast, and then you had stuff in the Chicago area. And a lot of times, all the rest of the country didn't get the trucks and everything that came in with all the items. So you found more in the other parts of the country. But the other thing that made the perfect sense to me is back then in 64, 65, when the local shop owner got his catalog out on Friday afternoon of what he was going to order for the next shipment that come in, well, he would look at some of these Beatle items that were out there, and he would go, well, you know, I think in a little town in Indiana, I can sell some buttons, I can sell maybe a pin or two, and maybe a couple of these dolls. These record players are too expensive. Or I want to buy one of these guitars, but they come in a case, and I can't afford the case, and I don't think I can sell them all in this area, so I'm not going to buy them. So what you find is all these other small towns and cities in all around the U.S., you might not have known these things existed just because you were at the mercy of what your local merchant wanted to buy and wanted to purchase for his shop at that time.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So the highest distribution points would be in the more populated areas and either end of the country and Chicago area in terms of availability and access to stuff. That makes sense.
Correct. And once I realized that and the light bulb went off on that, that's why I started getting all these people that said, I didn't even know half this stuff existed, sure. Which is another reason why I think this project is pretty neat, because I'm bringing this stuff to the masses that maybe thought they knew it all. And they're just amazed when I show them the list of all the items.
Hello. See these little fellas? They're the Beatles. Inflatable Beatles. They're yours, the four of them, for just $2 and two wrappers from Dove or Lux or Lifebuoy soap. You'll find the Beatles at your supermarket in this display. Here's John, Ringo, George, and Paul. For full details, visit this display at your supermarket and have the Beatles, all four of them, for your very own.
So as part of the process of this, when you started locating collectors around the country and then getting access to their collections and photographing their holdings, what was that like? Was there anything in particular that stands out as you started that process up?
Well, what happened to me with every single one of them, I would contact them and tell them who I was, and they were all wide open, you know, come on in, no problem. You know, they like for you to see their stuff. That's why they have their stuff.
Right.
But what always happened, I would visit them at their house, and they would take me down the basement, or they would take me in the back part of the house or whatever, and there was always this moment that they would open the door and just look at me, and I was speechless, because I just had no idea that you could collect some of these people. It was amazing. I mean, I stood there, even though I was there to, quote, work and to shoot some photos, I mean, the first few minutes there, I'm just in shock. I'm like the kid in the candy store, just going, oh my gosh, I don't even know where to start.
Right.
And finally, after I calmed down a little bit, I would turn on some of my professionalism and start asking, well, do you have this, this? I would like to photograph this. But it's just, some of these collections out there are just simply amazing. And I'm so thankful and glad that these people would allow me to come into their homes and all that and to shoot some photos and to talk to them about the information and their items on the shelf. Some of them, you could hold the items in your hand. They would let you, you know, some of them were behind glass and you could just see it through the glass, and that was as close as you were going to get to it. But wow, that's okay. That's okay. But that it was just a whole another interesting point of this whole process.
The house is a museum when people come to see them.
That was something that when I started writing books on the Beatles that I just kind of happened upon, is that if you're any kind of collector, there's nothing you like better than to show off your collection. And so I would hit up people for scans, like if they collected picture 45 sleeves or magazine covers, things like that, to use as illustrations in my book. So I did find that, contrary to what you might think, anybody that's got this stuff, oh, they want to share it.
Exactly. They want to show it to you, and they're smiling the entire time you're there because they know that their collection all is bringing some joy and some research and some stuff into what you're doing. So it was a phenomenal thing to go visit some of these things. Yes.
And now you've created this vehicle where their collections get way more exposure than it would ordinarily, because now anybody around the world can buy your book and they could point to a picture. Yep, that was when he came to my house and took that picture in my basement. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, so cool. So what was the range of private collections like? Can you give us an idea of, you know, one extreme to the other extreme?
Well, the ones I went to, I will admit, they were extreme. They were the oh my gosh moment. I mean, it almost, when that door opened up, it almost took your breath away for a second, because you just didn't know what to say. There's just so much they would collect. One of them collected a lot of things from the early 60s and then kept going on to collect the stuff, even the other waves that came in the 70s and the 80s. Another one just had all the 60s kinds of stuff and just had a massive amount of that kind of stuff. You know, and I would run into the kind of stuff that you would look for. The magazines were there. They'd have magazine racks.
Wow.
That they had carted down into their basement or whatever, and they'd have the magazines all line up in the racks and everything. I mean, it was just, for people like you and I, or people who were really like this stuff or into this stuff, it was one of those moments that you just, this is, I can't recreate today. I better take enough pictures, because I don't know if I'll ever get back to a place like this again.
Right, exactly. You described when you were looking at the headphones and then catching the handkerchief draped across a chair. What kind of things sort of blindsided you? Was there anything in particular that you stumbled across that you had no idea? Were there a lot of things like that? I'm just wondering what kind of things really surprised you as you're on your mission.
I think what was interesting to me is I'd have about 10 or 15 items wondering, okay, is this really a 60s items from there, or was this item from the 70s or 80s? So it was early on when I was trying to decide something, and I could walk in and I could see one of those things on the shelf, and I'd go, wait, what? Tell me about that. And mm-hmm. They would give me some additional information to help me in my research go, yes, I should include that, or no, now that I know more about that and this is a pretty good indicator, this collector knows what he's talking about, I realize that doesn't go into my stuff at all. But there's just so much out there. One of the collectors I walked in, and well, besides having all the NIM stuff and the Yellow Submarine and all that kind of stuff, you know, there's a whole wall of guitars there. They're all reproductions, but every one of the guitars they ever used were all lined up on the wall. And it's just like, oh my gosh, look at that. I mean, there's more people that need to come see this.
Sure.
Than just me. So the whole aspect of those things made that part of my research so much more enjoyable. Did I have to drive hours and hours to get to these things? I sure did. But boy, that was, the drive back just flew by, because all I could think of, I was so fired up and excited about how to utilize some of the information that I found in the book. That was pretty cool.
Was there anything in particular you were really trying hard to track down that you were never able to find anybody that had a good specimen worthy of inclusion?
again, the skateboard I have never been able to find. There was an apron. I had heard about it, and I had found pictures of it. It was just one of those things. For example, I put the book in alphabetical order. You know, I mean, that it might sound simple. It goes apron to wig is what it does. Because one of the frustrations I always had when I looked through the price guides and when I looked through books about Beatles items, they're really not really in alphabetical order. They're always in categories. Mm. You know, you look up the jewelry or you look up the dolls or whatever. Well, then first you got to find out what category they're in. Then you got to go find it within that. So I thought, by gosh, I'm just going to make one thing that goes right in alphabetical order. So you can, if you want to find a doll, you just go right to D. Well, apron was, I think, one of the first things that ended up being in the book was the apron. And I knew about it and all that. And it wasn't until just a few months before the book came out that I was still working on it that I had the apron in my hand. Wow. Shooting a photo of it. And I thought, well, this is pretty cool that I finally have stumbled across this. And yes, it did exist. And it was almost like thin paper by that time. But by golly, I had it in my hand and I got a nice picture of it.
Wow.
There's just so much stuff. When you start looking into the jewelry and the necklaces and that kind of stuff, there's so many of those little items out there that you're never sure whether you got all of them or not. There's always that little thing, am I going to stumble across something else? And I have found, and probably what you have found as a writer, one of the things that I have found is I was worried when I was going to stop.
Right.
Did I find everything that I was trying to find? If I say there were 150 items, well, the day the book comes from the printer, am I going to stumble across number 151? And I'm going to go, dang it, or, you know, or something like that.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because where you leave the book, it is ripe for some kind of sequel. Now, you can take it from 67 on through the end of the Beatles, because this show goes out around the world, and there's going to be people listening to this in Britain going, well, what about UK collectibles? You know, what about this? What about that? So you've got plenty of room to move, although I would think that you're logistically restricted to how easily you're going to be able to access things like that, apart from, you know, somebody in America that might have merch from around the world. So you've definitely got places you can go with this. Was there anything in particular, once you closed the book and got it off to the printers, that once your name got out there and the book got out there, did people start coming to you with, well, what about this? What about this? Were there other things that were coming your way in the wake of the book?
Well, I haven't ran into what about this or what about that. So I feel pretty confident about my list. What I have run into is what I think is pretty neat. I'll run into somebody that goes, well, did you know that the Remco company also did blah, blah, blah. And I thought, oh man, what a cool thing that I should have had in the book. And I will run across little things like that, mm-hmm. that in hindsight, I think would have fattened up even more some of the cool stories and about that. So what I have done, and this isn't a shameless plug, but what I have done is, you know, just like everybody, you start working on the ebook. Okay, the ebook is next for this kind of thing. Well, working on the ebook, it allows me to add little things in the text that maybe I didn't know at the time that you send the book to the printer. So the ebook will have all, it's going to look at the same, it's going to look the same, it's got the same everything in it, but it might have a few extra sentences or two every now and then, mm-hmm. that I think I have found things since that time that really is the kind of thing that needs to be in the book. Now, of course, I have run into maybe one or two things where somebody will come up and say, well, you listed that this item was made in 7 colors. Well, really, this one color was split into 2 types of colors, and so maybe you should have said 8. Well, okay, you know, I'll run into that kind of stuff every now and then, which is okay. Yeah. I have no problem with that, because right. I have found that my research did not stop the day that the books all arrived from the truck. I just keep going. I keep mm-hmm. this stuff, to me, just keeps getting more and more interesting. And I just keep finding more and more stuff. I was looking for something the other day about there's a thing called the disco case, where you used to be able to put your 45 records in it, and it helped you carry your records from house to house without them getting all messed up. Well, I'm finding more and more about the company that made these cases back then. Well, that's the coolest information. Well, I'm going to add that kind of stuff and other stuff like that to the ebook to just make it a little bit more of a fun environment, more cool stuff, more cool information within each of the items.
Mm-hmm. And then you could always do a second edition or revised edition of the hardcover book at some point down the road once you've accumulated enough stuff.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. Was there anything you came across or things that were out there, known to be out there, that you excluded for one reason or another that didn't fit the criteria?
Well, I kept away from what was known as the fake stuff. All right. You know, even back then in 64 and 65, 66, some of the business people amazingly would make fake stuff. And, and I tried very hard to stay away from that. I tried very hard to find for these 150 items, were they really stuff licensed by the Beatles management company? That was a hard thing in itself, is to make sure that an item was, quote, licensed or unlicensed. You know, there's, for example, there's some wigs out there that weren't licensed, but there's old commercials from 1964 and things that they're about the company making these wigs. Well, what they don't tell you is the company making these wigs, the wigs aren't licensed. They were just making them to try to make a quick buck while the Beatles were hot. So I tried to not get into those kinds of things. And they were all over the place out there. And my collectors would help with that. You know, some of these Facebook sites, the Beatles collectors and all that, these people are just wonderful. I am not ashamed to say I could throw a question out on the Beatle Collector Facebook site and say, hey, by the way, is this legit or not? Is this a license or unlicensed? And I'd have 20 answers within an hour, and all the answers would be good. And they would, in my opinion, they're all right, because these people are well-knowledged. So that, as a research thing, even though, you know, Facebook is Facebook, but right. What a research tool that you really can't ignore.
Yeah.
I mean, they know their stuff out there. And if there was ever a discrepancy or me wondering to finally do something or include it or not include it or use this line or not, I could throw something out there and I'd know within an hour whether I was right or whether I was wrong. And I would feel very confident about the information that I got out there.
And that's the great thing about your subject matter in this particular niche that you're mining, is that you've got people out there that are very, very hardcore, dedicated people that are very passionate about what they do. They're, you know, these hardcore train spotters that will get every detail right, every nuance right. And that's something that you've got that resource to tap, which is really cool. You know, somebody like me that does Beatle history and analysis and music and things like that, you know, I can't go to Facebook because I'll just get a bunch of opinions thrown at me based on nothing. Well, I read somewhere, you know, that kind of nonsense. But you're getting the hardcores that really are solid in their research. So that's a great thing to be able to draw upon.
Right. And they might throw an opinion in every now and then, but it's not, usually it's, no, I don't think that's real, or yes, that was, or, oh, by the way, as you're looking for that, did you realize that? And that took me down so many other avenues. And I have thanked them more and more times out there online about how they helped me. And not only that, you talk about people who want to share their collections with you. I would go out there and say, hey, by the way, I'm looking for this Beatle bobblehead doll, and I can't find a picture of John. Does anybody have one? Well, bang, 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 here comes all these images to me from the front, the back, the upside down, the all kind of stuff, close-ups and far away. And it's wonderful, because that helps solidify some of my research and all that. And they are more than passionate. Probably if I ask 100 of them, hey, this is a great image, can I use it in the book? 100 out of 100 would say yes, because they love this thing and they love this subject matter and they love to see their stuff out there and to share their stuff and to get their ideas and all and what they've got out there into this kind of form. It's been great.
What a great thing to tap into. Just occurred to me another place that I'm sure you checked out, but if I was doing something like this, one of the places that I've had some familiarity with is auction houses. If you go to their sites, because they'll a lot of times have past closed auctions up on their site, and they have these beautiful high-res pictures of, let's say, you know, Beatle artifacts and what the prices realized were, and a bit of history. Sometimes it's spot on and sometimes it's not, but it's another cool way of tracking things that are out there or circulating among collectors. Because I'm going to assume that if the places you want to visit, by nature of the beast, if you are one of these museum quality collectors, you got to have some deep pockets. And these are the kind of people that buy through auctions a lot of times.
Exactly. And I did use them a lot. And in fact, there was one auction house that I was out and I found a great high quality photo about something. And I wrote to the auction house. I said, you know, I'm doing the book. Could I use this image? I'll give you full credit and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I got a wonderful email back and said, yes, go ahead. We'd love to have you out there. Here's how you cite the image and all that kind of stuff. And then they said, and oh, by the way, we've got a massive collection coming out in a couple months. So if you keep watching our site, you will see that we'll keep adding more and more and more stuff like this that you could go ahead and use in your book. So it was like back to the kid in the candy store. I'm just every day going back to the site to see what all they'd added. And they did. They had all kind of stuff. And you're right about the descriptions that they will give about an item and everything are spot on. They have done their own research too, because of, like you said, there's going to be people buying that at some big bucks. So they want to make sure that that stuff is right. So that is a great place to start with a description of the item and all that, and use that and maybe just start going from there.
Yes, it's awesome. Well, you produced a terrific book. I hope you're going to do a second book, take it somewhere, because there's so much ground to cover. But this first step in this world, you've done a phenomenal job, and it's a beautiful book. I hope people do check it out, because as you say, the story is attached to the stuff. It's interesting to see the visuals, but you then extrapolate from that what it means to somebody who was a first generation fan that brought this into their homes and lived with it, and what it meant capturing that place in that time. Every one of these things tells a story, and that's what really makes it, in effect, some kind of storybook.
Thanks so much. We've had a great time putting this thing together. It's just, and it just keeps, as you say, it just keeps going and going. So we'll have to see next what we're going to do with this. But right now, it's pretty cool. And the stories I'm still getting back, and the little items from people and all that, just make it that much more worthwhile that I went down a good path here.
Excellent. So is there a particular website you'd want to direct people to check out your work beyond the normal online and brick and mortar book outlets?
What I always tell, the website link is so long. Just Google NIMS and the Business of Selling Beatles Merchandise in the U.S. from 1964 to 66. You'll find the website. It's also now out on Amazon. It's on eBay. It's on some other places. So you'll be able to find it out there.
Something About the Beatles, created and hosted by Robert Rodriguez, executive producer Rick Way, title song by The Corgis.
The Beatles are back in Britain, but their memorabilia lingers on. Part of it is here in the safety deposit vaults of the United of America Bank. And this valuable property is Beatle bedding. Some of the sheets and pillowcases used by the Beatles in their tour of the United States. One of those involved in the Beatle bedding business is Richard Victor, a Chicago television director. Mr. Victor, how did you get the Beatle bedding?
My partner, Larry Einhorn, outbid his competitors in the various hotels that Beatles stayed at.
Mm-hmm.
The Whittier Hotel in Detroit and the Muhlenbeck Hotel in Kansas City.
And what are you going to do with it?
We have cut these bedding sheets up into 1 square inch.
Now, how can we be sure that this is real Beatle bedding?
Oh, it's the real thing because the hotel manager of the Whittier Hotel and the Muhlenbeck Hotel signs an affidavit certifying that this is the Beatle bedding they slept on, and who slept on what sheet and was belongs to who, Ringo, George, or Paul.
Now, when you get these things cut up into 1 square inch apiece, what are you going to do with them?
Sell them.
How many do you think you're going to get?
Well, mathematically, which is the only way to do it, is about 150,000 square inches. And that's not including the pillowcases and the hand towels.
But what would you do with them?
Because we bought all the linen.
We bought all the linen.
Oh, yeah. We cornered the market on this. This is ours. The pillowcases we're going to give them to and donate them to charity for charities. Various charities in the country can make money off the Beatles as well as us, which is a nice thing.
But what you're going to do is sell these for $1 a square inch, and you're going to have 150,000 square inches.
Yes, they come on parchment paper with the autograph of the manager of the hotel, and 1 by 1 inch saying John, Ringo, or George slept here, and these are the real things. This is a memento of their North American tour. Those wonderful, clever boys.
It's a modern story of rags to riches. I forgot my outline.